Hello, I'm Carol.
And I'm Susan. Welcome to Kickapoo Dark Skies, where we'll explore the importance of dark nights and dark skies and how we are all made to live in a world that is dark half of every day. Today's program is sponsored by Polaris, the star we can all depend on to show us the way. Now, a word about our sponsor, Polaris.
Have you noticed how the sky appears to be always in motion? This is due to the rotation of the Earth on its axis. You can watch the sky and mark time by observing Polaris, also called the North Star. Think of Polaris as the center of a sky clock, and the stars and constellations as the hands of the clock. Watch as they appear to slowly move counterclockwise around Polaris, which always stays stationary, and with the stars marking time through the night as the Earth rotates on its axis. Polaris is not hard to find. Once you spot it, you easily can locate it in the northern sky. The Polaris, the North Star, can be seen every night of the year from the northern hemisphere. To find Polaris, it can be helpful to look at a star map. They are available for downloading from nightskynetwork.gov, a service of NASA. Any clear evening, look north to the Big Dipper. Now you are in Polaris neighborhood. The star map will orient you to Polaris and the stars which make up the constellations.
There are a few constellations that are near Polaris that never drop below the horizon. These constellations are known as circumpolar constellations, and they're visible all night, every night of the year for stargazers in all 48 contingent United States and much of Europe. There are six of them: Ursa Minor, the Little Dipper, or the Lesser Bear, where Polaris is located; Ursa Major, the Big Dipper, or the Greater Bear; Camelopardalis, I did say it, a faint constellation that represents a giraffe; Cassiopeia, the queen; Cepheus, the king; and Draco, the dragon. These six circumpolar constellations perpetually chase one another around Polaris.
However, be aware, this is not always true. In cosmic time, different stars take turns as our North Star. This occurs because the Earth wobbles slightly as it spins through space, similar to a spinning toy top wobbling as it slows down. As a result, the axis of the Earth does not always point at Polaris. Over a period of about 26,000 years, the Earth's axis traces out a huge circle in the sky, and over time, it points towards bright stars other than Polaris. In about 13,000 years from now, the North Star will be the bright star Vega. But for now, Polaris is our go-to North Star. And so it goes. The celestial hands of the clock of time keep moving. Thanks, Polaris.
Carol, our quiz question today is about the importance of dark skies for human health. Our listeners are concerned about their health and that of all living things. What's the quiz question today? It might be a challenge for some of us, but it should give us some understanding of the importance of a dark night sky.
The quiz question, Susan, is an interesting one. What is circadian disruption? Again, the quiz question is, what is circadian disruption? Stay tuned. We will give you the answer at the end of the program.
You are listening to WDRT 91.9 Viroqua. Carol, we have a question from a listener in Viroqua named Paul. Paul asks, light pollution is evident in the Driftless region where I live. I'm concerned. However, have there been any calculations made as to the yearly rate at which light pollution is increasing?
That's an important question, Paul. Thanks for asking. Light pollution is defined as light where it is not wanted or needed, affecting our health, the environment, and wildlife, and our ability to fully appreciate the night sky and the natural world around us. A study published in the journal Science found that the global average increase in light pollution is around 9.6% per year during the period of 2011 through 2022. According to recent studies, light pollution in the United States increased at a rate of approximately 10.4% per year, based on data from that same period. Here in the Driftless region, John Heasley conducted a study from 2021 through 2023 and found that the night sky brightness had increased by 50% or more in some areas. You're right to be concerned, Paul. I am too.
Well, today for our Kickapoo Nightlife interview, I have John Rummel with me. He's an amateur astronomer and member and past president of the Madison Astronomical Society. He's traveled widely in the U.S. looking for the darkest night skies for his photography. His images show the darkest of our night skies at their best, clear and filled with stars. Artificial light makes it often necessary to travel to find what is close to a normal, natural, dark night sky. John has learned a few things and made some observations about our skies on his extensive travels. To find out some of what he has learned and experienced while we're, well, there we go. I'm just going to read that one again and take that one out. Artificial light makes it often necessary to travel to find what is close to a normal and natural dark night sky. John's learned a few things and made some observations about our skies on his extensive travels and long nights looking up at the stars. So today we're going to find out some of what he's learned and experienced while finding these star-filled night skies. Hello, John. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let's start by telling our listeners how you became an astronomer and a photographer of starry skies.
Well, I was one of those 10-year-old kids who somehow got the astronomy bug. I grew up in the age of the Apollo missions, and so fascination with space was part of my childhood. And somehow a telescope came along with that. So I don't remember how I got my first one. It was probably a Christmas present from the Sears catalog when I was a kid. Wasn't a great telescope, but it was good enough for me. I grew up in Maryland, and I remember sitting out in front of my house on cold nights when my parents and sisters thought I was nuts for being outside in those conditions, but looking at Jupiter, Saturn, the moon, and just being fascinated with the night sky. I lost touch with astronomy in high school and college as other life events became more important, but I took that telescope with me from place to place and finally gave it away in graduate school because I couldn't carry it anymore, and I knew it was a pretty cheap telescope. It wasn't worth keeping. And it was actually my wife that got me back into the hobby as an adult. She knew of my interest in astronomy, knew enough that she went out and did some shopping and found a good telescope, not a department store telescope, but she got a good one at Wild Birds Unlimited and gave it to me, I think for Christmas. It might've been my birthday. And the first night out with that new telescope, I knew that I had made a mistake by giving up the hobby all those years before. I was about 32, 33 years old when that happened, and I've been involved in the hobby ever since, going on over 30 years now. Found the Madison Astronomical Society and got involved with photography because of astronomy. I wanted to take pictures through the telescope, and so I started messing around with cameras and finding out what kind of cameras you needed. And so still to this day, very involved in both astronomy and astrophotography.
Yeah, they're a great combination. What I think is interesting here is that even as a fairly young child, you were able to use a telescope and get a lot out of looking at the sky. Doesn't have to be hard or complicated to really enjoy the stars.
Yeah. Bright objects. And the cool thing about looking at bright things is, you know, back in those days, I didn't have star charts, I didn't have books, I didn't have guides, there was no internet. And so I looked at that bright star and was shocked to discover that it was not a star. It was the planet Saturn. And I just remember the thrill of independently discovering the planet Saturn at age 10.
Yeah, that's a feeling we don't get when we can look things up and then go see them. But that sense of wonder when you discover something is pretty special. Yeah. I saw a total
Absolutely.
eclipse of the moon once as it rose that I didn't know was going to happen. And I had that kind of feeling of astounded awe, figuring out what was going on, and a sense of what people would have felt thousands of years ago who didn't know what it was. You know,
Yeah,
so
it's
it's
easy
pretty
to
special.
see why mythologies and even religions grew up around these spectacles.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing when you meet them without much filter. You just meet them directly. Yeah. Well, of all the places you've visited, you've traveled the United States a lot, going to dark sky spots. Do you have any favorite places that really stand out to you? Or I'm wondering if once it gets dark and you're looking up at the sky, it doesn't really matter where you are.
That last statement is definitely true. Once you're in a really dark place, it really doesn't matter whether you're in a state park, a national park, or in somebody's backyard, or you know, the city dump outside a really remote dark place. But I've been to a lot of great places, and I have a lot of favorites. But the one I would pick right now is my most recent one. Back in about 2012, 2013, I was at a location in Grand Teton National Park because I wanted to take a particular shot over the Grand Teton Range. And the site was very carefully selected, traveled a long way to get there. And on the night of this photograph, I blew it because I messed up my camera settings. And I walked away from that night with no shot. And I was so disappointed. And that was more than 10 years ago. And I got a chance during a trip this summer to return to Grand Teton National Park, drove 800 miles in one day to get there at sunset, set up my camera, and stayed most of that night at that location, nailed the shot, got up the next morning, shot a couple pictures of sunrise at the Tetons, and then I was on the road driving home. So I drove thousands of miles to get to Grand Teton National Park in the dark. Didn't stay to see it in the sunshine, and then the next day drove away, but I got the shot in this location. It's called String Lake near Jenny Lake in Grand Teton. And I got the shot that I screwed up all those years ago. And so right now that's it hangs in my bedroom. It's my favorite shot right now because the satisfaction of going back after 10 years and redeeming myself.
That's a great story. It's kind of inspiring to make that effort for whatever the rest of us want to do, that it can pay off to make that effort. That's pretty cool you did that.
Well, yeah, that story also encapsulates the fact that I do some really ridiculous feats of driving in order to get to some of the places that I want to go.
Yeah, because those places are all a long ways from anywhere else. Yeah, and the roads aren't always the best.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you've been paying attention to the night sky for so many years. And I'm interested in, because we all know that the light pollution levels have been increasing quite rapidly. And I'm interested in how that affects the photography you do and the astronomy too. But I would think you'd have to, I might be wrong, but I think you'd have to compensate somewhat for the light that's filling up the sky when you're trying to get a certain type of star picture. Do you have to compensate, and can you compensate for ambient light pollution?
You can, and I do. A lot of the pictures that I take, I mean, I post-process my pictures in Photoshop. And that is not to say that I create scenes that didn't exist in reality. When I use Photoshop, it is specifically to try to bring a photograph that I've taken back to what I regard as the natural look. This is what it really looked like to the naked eye. Many nighttime photographs can be overexposed to a degree where the Milky Way looks very unnatural. The Milky Way is a faint, large, diffuse object. And in pictures, it should look faint, large, and diffuse. I have made mistakes in processing Milky Way photos before where naive observers looked at a photo of mine and said, "Wow, that's great." And then a pause. "What is that, a forest fire?" And I knew when that comment was made, I knew that I had failed because this picture did not look like the night sky to that viewer. And so I learned from that. And so I do a significant amount of post-processing in order to create a photo that looks real and looks natural. And to answer your question about compensating for light pollution, yeah, there are places where I go where it's not dark enough. And if you shoot a 15, 20, 30 second exposure where there is ambient light pollution, that 20 or 30 second exposure is going to exaggerate that light pollution to a degree where it will ruin the photo, if not for some artful, careful post-processing. So yes, I do utilize post-processing, but I don't create things that don't exist.
Well, our eyes would just see the same amount of light. It does, our eyes don't keep getting more and more light in, but the longer you leave that camera open, the more light it gathers, so the brighter it looks. It doesn't
Yeah.
work the way our eyes do.
Yeah, you have to be careful.
75% of the population in this country don't see more than a few stars if they look up because they are under a lot of light pollution. What can you say about the lived experience when you go out to these really dark places and you're out there alone? Maybe I don't know if you go with other people, or I'm sure you're alone some of the time. Can you tell people what it's like to be under a sky like that, especially when you're out far away from anywhere and there's a lot of wilderness around you? And that kind of experience that's so different from what you have where there's a bunch of lights around on the horizon and you see some stars. Can you talk about what that's like?
Well, it's gratifying the number of people who go to places like that. Let's use state and national park campgrounds as an example. The number of people who are there who really do appreciate the skies that they will see once it gets dark. There are exceptions, and there are people who bring way too many artificial lights to a situation like that. But I found that most people in wild and natural areas like that, they come for the waterfalls and they come for the canyons and they come for the daytime activities, but they also come for the nighttime. So many of those people are well prepared in a well-rounded way. So they do appreciate the night sky. I've got a strategy that I use to kind of give myself the best chance of having a good night. If I'm camping by people with RVs, or just campgrounds that are strung with lights. I introduce myself to them and I tell them I'm a photographer and I tell them what I'm doing. And I offer to take a portrait of their family under a starry sky. And they're all fascinated by this. This, like, boy, we're going to go home with some souvenirs, but this is a great one to go home with. I wasn't expecting that. And so I prime them and I prep them that after it gets dark, here's what I need you to do. I'm going to come over at this time, say 9 p.m., and you need to have the lights off and you need to let your fire burn down to the embers. So don't give it any wood for the, half an hour before I come over. And by offering to do a portrait of them, I'm carefully priming them to behave in a way that I want them to behave after it gets dark. And I go over and I take my picture and I show it to them on the little LCD on the back of the camera, get their email address, and promise to send it to them the next week when they get home. People are so thrilled and so happy. And that starts all of the right conversations to have about threats to the night sky, even out here in the middle of nowhere, at the campground at Bryce National Park or, something like that. And I love having those conversations because people are careful then. And the next time they go camping, maybe they bring a red flashlight instead of a white flashlight. Little victories like that are tiny, but they're meaningful, certainly for me and maybe for those families that I introduced, a national park to in a new way.
That's the way the change happens, is you make friends and do something good for them like that. That's a great story.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, being out here in the Driftless sometimes and then being in all these other places, can you give any kind of an honest appraisal of how our dark skies here line up in the just in the last year or so with other dark skies in Wisconsin? Because we're feeling we've really lost some of the darkness here. And you've been out here. Do you feel like this is a still a valuable dark sky place to go to and to try to recoup some of that darkness? Are we still in the running here?
I think you are definitely still in the running, and I still value the skies in the Kickapoo, Wildcat, in that general area, and broader areas out in southwestern Wisconsin also. So I know what you're talking about when you talk about the backpedaling that has happened out there because of the growth in the light signature from the small towns out there. But dark skies are an experience in relativity. So me living in the suburban sprawl of Madison, it's bad where I live. Not as bad as Milwaukee or Chicago, but I don't get a quality night sky experience here. So when I drive to Lafarge and go north, I really appreciate the darkness of those skies. In Wisconsin, by Wisconsin standards, those are among the best skies in the state, notwithstanding, the backsliding that has happened over the last 4 or 5 years. It's still good, still worth fighting for to keep it that way. It's still worth fighting for to make up for some of the ground that you've lost because of the encroachment of those lights from Lafarge or Ontario or Viroqua or wherever. But I still regard your skies as one of the jewels of the state.
Well, thank you. And we're working hard to try to keep it that way and improve it if we can.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. You're working with Dark Sky Wisconsin. It's an organization that's working all over the state with smaller groups to conserve dark skies and work with these different issues related to that. Can you tell us anything about what Dark Sky Wisconsin is doing and how listeners could get involved with them and help protect dark skies through associating with a little bigger organization like that?
So Dark Sky Wisconsin is still a very new group, very young, very as yet developmental. We are a chapter of the larger group that many of your listeners may be familiar with, the International Dark Sky Association, now renamed Dark Sky International as of 2023. So Wisconsin is officially a state chapter of the international organization. So our goals are the same as Dark Sky International's. We want to educate people about the negative effects of excess lighting, of light pollution. We are a dark sky advocacy group in the sense that everybody appreciates the night sky, and everybody should be aware of what we can do to appreciate the night sky and what we can do to preserve it in places where it's endangered. So we do spend a lot of time talking about artificial lights and their use and their misuse. There's the misperception that we're trying to take away people's lights and make people feel less safe, and that's absolutely the farthest thing from what we want to do. We understand that people need lights in their homes and their cities and their places of business or whatever. And we're not opposed to lights. We are opposed to badly designed lights, and there are a lot of badly designed lights. You can accomplish the same thing with a well-designed light, and you can save electricity, you can save fossil fuels, and you can save the environment at the same time you're helping to preserve a dark sky.
Yes, we're doing the same thing here, and I'm hoping that people can see there's a larger collaboration and maybe they can see more than one way to get on board and help with one organization or the other. You've got some presentations that I think are really interesting, and they're on the university, I don't know what you call it, video channel or whatever, and YouTube. Do you want to say something about where you can see those presentations you've done? I thought they were fascinating. They're on interesting little aspects of looking at the sky.
Well, by far, the most talks that I have given have been to the Madison Astronomical Society right here in Madison. For the last 4 years or so, we have been recording our meetings and preserving them on YouTube. So if your listeners go to YouTube and search for Madison Astronomical Society, they will find our channel. And on that channel, they will find most of the talks that we have recorded over the past 4 years. We started recording our talks when COVID drove us online, as COVID did many organizations in 2020. So we don't have the whole history of the group, but we have a good 4 years. And I've given a few presentations on topics related to dark skies during those 4 years, two of which I think you're referring to because I sent you the links. People can go on our YouTube channel and find those talks and much else that the Madison Astronomical Society has to present. Unfortunately, once you've found our YouTube channel, I've found that searching for specific presentations is not absolutely the easiest thing. You would think it would be much easier because YouTube is owned by Google and Google knows a thing or two about search. The search inside YouTube is not that great. So, for instance, and maybe it's just because of me, because when I search for my name pops up all over a lot of MAS stuff, not just the specific talks that I gave. That might be why it's hard for me. But yeah, it's all online and people can find it easily by searching in YouTube for the Madison Astronomical Society.
Yeah, I recommend people do it. They're entertaining and interesting presentations. I think we're getting close to running out of time, John. So I want to thank you for offering an interesting perspective of what you can do with going out and looking at the dark. And I know some people have tried to take pictures of the Northern Lights when they were out a few weeks ago and things like that. So you can do a lot with the photography, and you can do a lot with going out to these different places and taking a look when you're traveling. So thank you very much. And it's just been really great to talk to you. I'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
That was very interesting listening to John. Now it's time for the answer to today's quiz question: what is a circadian disruption?
Humans evolved with the rhythms of the natural light-dark cycle of bright days and dark nights, which became our circadian rhythm. Before the advent of artificial lighting, we spent our evenings in relative darkness. Like most of on the Earth, we adhere to a circadian rhythm. It is our master clock, which is crucial for all our overall health. It interacts with our body systems, changes our hormone levels, and even modifies our genetic code. Natural light helps to keep our inner clock in tune with Earth's 24-hour cycle. When our master clock is out of sync with the day-night cycle, it's called circadian disruption. Disrupting or altering our normal circadian rhythm can put us at risk of physiological and behavioral issues and can affect our natural sleep patterns too. A good night's sleep is important to our daily functioning and also feels so good.
Well, Carol, it looks like we have come to the end of our January program. Stay warm and bundle up when you go out to view the night sky. January offers some of the best viewing.
And remember, choose your outdoor lights carefully.
Dark skies are important to the health of people and all living beings. I'm Susan.
And I'm Carol. Thanks for joining us.
Remember, turn off your lights, go outside, and look up at the stars.